Hello and welcome back to the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. I'm just putting a little cover on this podcast, even though I wasn't able to be there on the day. Sam went down to Urban Golf and managed to sit down with owner James Day to talk about his extremely interesting career. James was a very successful junior, went on to become a pro and kind of became disenfranchised with the game, went off for a little while into the golfing wilderness, then revived the love for it by taking over Sounder Golf and Urban Golf. And Sounder, for those of you who don't know, is like a fashion and lifestyle brand. And back in the day, Seve used to play Sounder irons, and I think the spirit of the way that Seve played his golf is kind of what the guys down at Sounder are trying to bring back now. And listeners to this podcast do get a discount with Sounder Golf. You can go over to their website by putting Cookie Jar in at checkout. But it's a fascinating podcast. James has had a fascinating life in the game, and I hope you guys enjoy it as much as I did. Enjoy. Watch this. Hello and welcome back to the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. Sam today, and I'm joined by an illustrious guest, our second Eclectic 18 guest. I don't know quite how to introduce you here, James. So usually we'd sort of give a bit of a, you know, this is James Day and this is what he does, and then we'd go from there. James Day, I would say maybe modern day Ben Hogan. Is that a fair?
Don't know about that, mate.
I know, I feel like I've maybe likened you to God, but I think there's some similarities there, no?
I've cobbled an existence together through a golf obsession.
With Hogan, right?
Yeah.
There's a few things. There's the baggy slacks, ripping darts around the course,
yeah.
Swing planes flat as hell.
The greatest golf course dart is the Angel Cabrera on the 18th of the US Open. Was it Shinnecock?
Yeah.
So I think Cabrera, when you hit that drive down 18... the driver was in the bag, head cover on, dart lit before it landed.
See, that's remarkable behaviour. Yeah. That exceeds even Hogan's.
But we don't see a lot of that these days, do we?
No. And I think golfers smoking is for some reason iconic on Instagram, which is probably a topic we'll circle back around on. But, you know, just bringing it back to Hogan for a second, you know, there is an obsession there, right? You know, the classic shoes. There's a purity, I think, to Hogan's kind of enjoyment of the game, and I sense that, you know, we've played golf today, we've hung out quite a bit,
but it's more that era, isn't it? It's more that, I think it is, you know, like when you look up there and you think to yourself, you know, we've got this set of irons here which are supposed to be Jack Nicklaus's exact spec, and he was playing majors with those, and he was hitting that one iron in majors. You know, that is another planet, isn't it, of skill and precision. And like I say, I think sometimes when people talk about equipment, you know, if everybody's on a reasonably level playing field, which might, of course, be defined by just the era they're living in, but you want there to be an emphasis on skill. And these guys, I mean, when was the mad one iron that Faldo hit into the 18th in a US Open?
Jeez, now, I mean, you just can't spring these questions podcast hosts.
It doesn't matter,
mid-episode.
But everybody knows there is one, and he's got the TP19 one iron or whatever. And it's just,
elite knowledge.
You know, to do that on the 18th of a major, we don't really see that anymore, do we, sadly?
I mean, look, we've spent time together. We'll do a proper introduction in a second. But, you know, I think I'd preface this podcast with, I would see you as probably one of the game's purists. We are sat in like a cove of maybe, what are we at, 6 feet by 4 feet or something here, with the best part of 150 persimmon woods hanging over my head, probably the best part of 400 shafts.
I never thought
some vintage tour bags.
I never thought I'd fill that rack, but it is
and
looking quite
full. What I believe to be the autumn winter collection for Sounder Golf, yeah, as well, on the next rail, which is you know, a business obviously that you manage with your partners. And you know, golf fashion is another big part of your life. Before we go there, your journey in golf, talk us through, like, easiest question for a podcast host, but where did it all start with golf?
I always say this to people with kids. It's like, you know, get them to hit balls, take them to hit a few shots, but really they're either going to, I don't know what it is, it's obviously a certain personality type, but they're either going to love it and they're going to become obsessed with it or they're not. I don't think there's that many people actually that sort of dabble with golf. And I was just always fully obsessed with it. You know, I don't know whether early on it was just because my dad played and, you know, I wanted to be like my dad or whatever, but it was always a big thing to me. And I think, you know, looking back, you do these things at that age, don't you? You're trying to be better and you want to be competitive because that's what you think you should be doing. But I loved the game and I loved practicing, and I think I got quite good at quite a young age, but I was never very good at competing.
When did you start? When was the first ball struck?
Oh, I can't remember not playing. So I was showing my girlfriend some of the pictures from my dad had taken in our back garden. I'd be out there, you know, wearing my dad's size nines when I was 3 years old and on the wrong feet and stuff, you know, wacky. My dad got me a bullseye putter and he cut it down. I don't know whether he thought that meant I was going to develop a great short game or whatever, but I remember we went down to Spain and I was about 5 years old, hit a couple of putts, and then I just went down the range and started ripping the bullseye as hard as I could off the tee. That was my first club. And my brother and I had a pet. We had a so to go and play at the golf club, you could play after a certain time, and we had one pair of ladies' golf shoes, so we used to take it inside. And then one day my dad came back from work with remember how some golf shoes used to look? These things were, they had the Velcro strap going across them and pimple spikes. Yeah, yeah. My dad came home from work and said, oh, we can all go and play. We can play as a three ball now. I'm not actually saying we were poor. I don't know why he was so tight. and my brother and I would have these arguments about who was going to wear the shoes, which a lot of times the argument ended up in only one of us going. And we lived literally, I mean, our house wasn't on the course, but the house backing onto us was on the course. So,
and where was that?
Flackwell Heath.
Okay.
Yeah, I could bunk off school. The turning to go down a road to get onto the 15th tee was on the way to my bus stop for school.
No way.
Yeah.
So, you know, from a very early age, golf, you know, threw you like a stick of rock. You know, I feel like, you know, knowing what I know, and we'll talk about it now, but probably already sensed that there was going to be, golf was going to be the pastime somehow. When did the penny drop where it was like, do you know what? Yeah, golf is, that's the vehicle for me long term in my career, my life, where I go.
I think very young. But I also think I didn't really understand how, because it became a part of my life so quickly, I didn't really understand how much I loved it and how I felt about it. It was just there. And I hated school. You know, I used to get so depressed on a Sunday night. And when I was about 13 years old, and I wrote a letter to what was Stoke Poge at the time, then was Stoke Park, and is now sadly closed. And that was where all the good players from our area would congregate and be members and play, and it was a great course and the greens were great. So I wrote a letter to them asking if I could have a membership, which they very kindly gave me. You weren't allowed to be a member if your parents weren't a member, but they let me play there. And then I had these years playing at Stoke and being around some really good players. And I think, as much as anything, you know, to be honest with you, that a lot of these guys were great players, and there's nothing, you know, Dave Fisher won the Brabazon in the stroke play or the match play in the same year. Van Phillips was European Tour winner. Charlie Challen had the course record at Sunningdale. But they were these guys who were like, you know, they were in their early 20s. They were cool guys and they were great players. And so very quickly, that was what I wanted.
Yeah.
And the reason that that's what I wanted was because I didn't want to go to school on Monday. You know, so that it very quickly became an escape for me, which could have obviously ended in disaster, but fortunately it didn't.
So school rather kind of tailed off a little bit. You kind of what?
Couldn't wait to get out.
GCSEs and done.
Done,
so
yeah,
six, for our US out. Audience, that's sort of 16 years of age, school's done.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to play US Open, we're going to play Open, Masters, we're going to get some major titles under our belt, and that's the
I don't
rest
know
is
if
history.
I ever
was that the goal?
That. Well, I don't know if I ever thought that, but yeah. And against a lot of resistance, you know, Dad didn't really want me to do it. It was sort of mixed emotions, really, because Dad quite liked it when I was a good player, but then equally, he very quickly started to see that it was going to stop me from staying at school. So
yeah.
So came out of school, decided that I was just going to play full-time golf, which meant hanging out with these guys at Stoke 7 days a week rather than just the weekends, which is great. And was obviously delusional. You know, I wasn't going to be, you know, I could hit golf shots, but I wasn't good at shooting scores and playing in tournaments. You know, I used to choke and, you know, used to play in the big stuff. I remember I...
terrified of leaderboards.
Yeah, the year I left school, I played in the McGregor Trophy, which was the English under-16s, which Justin Rose won that year. And I, on the 14th hole of the first round, I saw myself on a leaderboard, two off the lead, and I missed the cut. So, and I swapped caddies. I had my brother caddying for me, and we swapped caddies with one of the guys in our group.
Because we're so yippee. Hang on, whoa. This podcast has just taken an immediate detour. Can we just rewind a little bit to the missed cut in the McGregor, please? So what happened with the caddies? Because I feel like there's a story there. Your brother was caddying for you.
Yeah, my brother drove... well, to be honest with you, there's a bit more to this story. So it's a bit in between us, really. So the moment I left school, myself and two of my friends from school managed to convince one of our mums, a Swedish lady, smoking, to take us to Ibiza. So we went to Ibiza for a week, 15, 16-year-olds, and went to a few nightclubs and had a whale of a time, didn't sleep very much. And we came back and I slept for, I think I sort of stayed in my bedroom for about 3 days. And then my brother drove me to the McGregor up in Nottingham. I don't think I'd even been up north at that point. Drove me in his 0.9 Fiesta with the boot falling out to play in the McGregor, stayed in some B&B. And I don't know what, I can't remember well enough, but it was a pretty significant meltdown. And yeah, we swapped caddies. My brother and I were arguing a bit, and the other guy had his sister caddying for him, so we swapped.
So there was another family feud going in across the fairway, and said, "Well, look, should we just simplify this a little bit?"
Yeah.
Jeez, was that a bit of an MO then? So your brother caddying and trying to support you a little bit through
we had some of the ups tournaments and downs, and, sometimes, but yeah,
six irons thrown really at each other.
To be honest with you, I never had a sustained period of playing competitive golf. It was always a bit broken up. And so then, you know, going on from that, I'm, you know, knobbing about, not really getting anywhere, not really even trying to get anywhere, but just got myself out of school. Good. And then the assistant pro job came up at Flackwell, which I took, and we had quite a commercial and brilliant wrong-un of a pro. You won't mind me saying that, Paul Watson. He was great. You know, very, you know, some club pros are sort of quite sleepy, sort of not very commercial mode, but he was great. He was very, he really pushed us, and he made us work quite hard. And he made me, I guess I'd probably grown up at the golf club, I'd become a bit of a renegade and didn't really probably upset a few people. And he said, you know, now you've got to be friends with everyone, which is probably really good for me. And so, yeah, made friends with everyone, had a lovely time, started my PGA training. Got that manual with the club repair bit in.
This way you have to change a grip in like 5-10 minutes or something.
Yeah,
or something,
and we
like
had
that.
A little workshop out the back of the shop, which I got into and was doing my PGA training, which I hated, and playing like, that's when I started to not love golf at all, really, at that point. Playing like weird pro events and feeling completely out of my depth, and I never really completed anything as a golfer. You know, I never became good in one category and then moved on.
I feel like, because the catalyst for doing this podcast, we were very lucky in having our Christmas party at Urban Golf, which is where we sat now, which is another one of your businesses in London. And a mighty fine place, I will add. And we're very lucky. We went to play at Rye the next day, which is a club that is close to your heart and somewhere you're a member at. And we're on the train on the way back, and you sort of said, like, you know, it's kind of, I seem to remember we're sort of like monologuing to each other after a good long day, and you were saying, you know, just as a pro, I was like, this guy's a pro, and you just hated golf. Like, I got to a point where, you know, I was just disillusioned with the sport, which I found to be quite jarring, because when, you know, through Cookie Jar, we're lucky to meet a lot of people who love the game at a really intense level, and I'd put you right up there in the top echelons of those people. Just talk to me a bit about that, because, you know, where you're at now and your passion for the game and what, you know, the stuff you do and that you're involved in must be poles apart from where that was in kind of what, early 20s, I'm guessing?
Well, I didn't know any different. For me, golf was playing, you know, a couple of nice courses, not really taking it in. BB&O, you know, there are some good courses, but it's not the best area in golf. you know, going off on golf trips to Spain and Portugal and playing those places, but never being really necessarily engaged in it in that way. And I guess,
was it the courses then? Do you think that was the issue?
I think what's interesting is that if you take the sort of version of the game that is presented as the sort of mainstream version, you know, you go and play these courses that the pros play, and yes, they're in good condition, but really, they're not gonna move you. And that was all I knew. I hadn't really played any links golf. I remember, you know, we were talking a bit earlier. The guy who, Craig, his name was, he used to come around and sell us accessories off of his van, was a country member at Hayling Island, and I went down there with him. I'd played links golf at Trevose before when I was a teenager, but really was my introduction to links golf. And the thing that struck me was that I couldn't play the shots. It was a bit windy, and I couldn't, you know, there were certain holes into the wind. I was hitting a big spinny draw. And I think that's another interesting thing. So my ball flight has completely changed through playing this golf.
Just by putting yourself through more firm and fast.
Completely
and,
changed, more neutral.
You know, windy conditions, exposing yourself to courses over that don't play like that.
Yeah. And so that created a little bit of fascination. And then, you know, I was at Stoke Park. I was teaching. I was into my teaching. I'd got into messing around with clubs. We had a workshop at Flackwell, and then I convinced Paul, the pro, that we could make a decent margin by doing custom equipment. And so we set up this custom equipment operation with really no knowledge, you know, just basic, the repair stuff that you would get through the PGA. And I remember I was thinking about this the other day because it's so different to the way I look at it now. I thought that I had to have every demo club. So I had to be, it was a process of elimination. I thought, so I'd go down the range with like all these clubs and get people to hit shots, and then we'd slowly whittle it down. And, you know, to where I am today, where I've, be honest with you, I prefer not to get any demo clubs out. But, you know, that's what I thought it was. And so that started my obsession with, I was always obsessed with equipment. I think equipment is the thing.
Well, clearly, I've got just immediately over my right shoulder, I think I've got something in the order of 50 bladed irons that would probably be somewhere between 1980 and 1999. It's an absurd collection.
But it's, you know, so people play golf for slightly different reasons. I play golf because I love hitting shots. And I love that experience of, like, you know, when you just totally nut one and it comes off perfect and it's just what you had in your mind's eye. And I have this, and I've reverse engineered this, I guess. But I just think with clubs, it's the club you do it with can make that experience quite a lot better. And the interesting thing about that, I think, is that the gap between maximizing performance and getting all of that is not as big as most people think. And I think that's because of the way that clubs have been sold over the years, which is forgiveness, which is... It's a pretty false...
You think it's a bit of a marketing ploy there? Well, Do you think there's more players that can get the purity of a bladed strike?
And... It's like, you know, if you go back to the time when Nicklaus or Trevino or these guys were on tour, they had club makers who were shaping soles, were understanding how their divots looked and were working on the clubs with them and were engaging with them on that level. And I think those guys had... way, not only the pros that were playing at that time were way more engaged in their equipment and had way more knowledge about their equipment, but also the club makers, there was more of a craft to it and there was more of a skill to it. And I think it would be very sad if that went away. There's loads of examples of this, but I guess
we've got a really good example up here. I think we've got, what are we looking at here? Just at the top shelf. You were telling me about these that came out earlier.
Yeah,
so I've got a one iron here in my hand, a McGregor. What is this? This feels like about a 7-iron length in my hand.
So it's ridiculous to say this, but I've bought these without really researching that much about the history of them. But these were made in 1986, and they're the 25th commemorative edition of the exact spec of Jack Nicklaus's clubs, which I can't remember what they're called, like an R58 raw head or whatever. But these would have been hand-shaped, Don White or Clay Long or someone like that. And they really understood what Nicklaus wanted from clubs. You know, it was
how he interacted with the turf, at a one iron, which is the one I've pulled out there.
Really dialed in. And there's a lot of stuff that those guys would have done that was very specific to them. I guess the most interesting thing is like those, they would have played, he would have actually played with just that standard pitching wedge and then that sand wedge, which is like a completely different tool.
It's completely different
setup.
It's got a
big wide sole on it. But he would have done everything with that. He would have done all the shots around the greens, all those cheeky little, you know, shots that need to come in high off tight lies and stuff like that. He would have just manufactured those out of the sandwich. And then he's carrying a 1-2-3, which, I mean, the difference between those has got to be ball flight. There can't be that much distance difference unless he's an absolute monster and can get that much speed. So I don't know. It's weird, isn't it? It's very interesting to
it's
think
very
about.
Different to where the clubs would be fitted today.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that was better, actually. I think that's a lot worse. But I think that, you know, you could bring both things to it. And I'm very interested in the what clubs do to people.
Yeah.
So the way that the adjustments that a club creates. And that's a whole rabbit hole we could go down.
Well, I think we probably will go down there. I'm conscious that this is an Eclectic 18 podcast, which is really about course pornography, for want of a better term. And, you know, we've very quickly there jumped off into swing mechanics and, well, certainly club technology. So you just kind of bit of a potted career around you in golf. You've kind of gone through this sort of junior professional academy route. You're now working, you know, in a professional role, not particularly enjoying it, but there's an interest there in terms of, you know, artisanal clubs, you know, bespoke equipment and stuff. Where's the kind of big sort of watershed moment? Where does James Day then sort of jump over and it starts becoming about, because, you know, we're going to talk about your Eclectic 18 in a minute,
yeah,
and there's a load of courses on there. Frighteningly good courses, yeah, that I suspect, and I asked you before we started recording this podcast, did you play many of these, you know, sort of pre sort of loving golf, you know, that kind of like the dark years or whatever? Where does that change?
I'll try to give you a really short answer. So when I went to be a pro at Stoke Park, I ended up doing a lot of teaching, and there wasn't much. We used to do fittings, but it was really just around demo clubs. We weren't building anything in the workshop. So that's a bit of a dark period with no workshop. My mum put a shed in our, I lived with my mum at the time. She put a shed in our garden and managed to get electricity off there into there, and I had a little workshop in the garden so I could do a bit of stuff. But it's a period where I wasn't really doing anything with equipment, so that's say 2000, and then go to Stoke, start doing loads of teaching, make some really great friends through that, and coming to the end of my PGA training, I had the idea to do an indoor golf place in London, and I sort of pitched it to a few guys that I'd become friendly with, and I mean, don't know how it happened really. August 2004, we opened in Soho, Urban Golf. 6 simulators, bar. We had a guy managing it who was like a really cool nightclub manager, and it was, I immediately moved to London.
And that was it? That was professional
yeah,
life over?
My life just changed. I mean, I was still, I mean, I was 24. I had those years at that point, which were running a golf business that wasn't really a golf business. You know, it was this, those simulators were pretty, I mean, those simulators still exist today and they're successful, but I thought they were pretty bad. And it didn't sit right with me. It didn't feel like a golf business. I was enjoying living in London. I was enjoying going out and having a great time, but, I always wanted it to be a bit better. So then I went down this rabbit hole of technology and golf simulators, started to develop my own golf simulator, which the launch monitor from that I did with some friends from New York. And I still use that for fittings today because it takes a really good photograph of impact. And then we opened another one, which is the one we're in now. So the first one was in Soho. 2 years later, we opened this one in Smithfield. Borrowed a ton of money, it was hard. and then we were going to open a third one in Kensington, and I'd got to the point where we'd been developing our own sim, and I'd put this workshop in here, which was a bit of a dirty secret, sort of down in the corner.
It's a great workshop, by the way. Like, it's, I don't know what the rules
they
are.
They got,
I
mean, back to having a workshop, that's the important
what
thing.
What are the rules if people come here and they are absolute golf perverts and they say, look, you know, just want to see some elite blades. What are the rules? Just rules of engagement here.
There aren't any. Look, I mean,
can they see it?
Yeah. Look, I sort of treasure the fact that this bit is not very commercial.
No, this is just,
I think it's good to have something which is completely uncommercial. And I
this stuff's off the menu.
I think if I was if I gave as much thought to this stuff, equipment, golf, all this stuff, and it was only about me, I could, that's a bit selfish. So it's nice when people that I know who, and you build this relationship with it. And to be honest with you, it's much nicer than teaching, because you do this thing, it takes about 2 or 3 weeks, and then you go, oh, brilliant, see you, you know, and you stay in touch. And so it's just something I really treasure, and it's, and I don't run it particularly commercially, but so we had this place, and then made this big decision to change over to the simulators we use today, which I swear by this, is that we wouldn't be here if we were still using the original simulators that we had at that time. These are like camera driven, and all of a sudden the business started to change and it became a lot more golfy. And that coincided with really at that time. So 2004 to 2014 for me was, no, I mean, I didn't mark a scorecard for 12 years.
No way.
I played loads of golf. I was still a pro.
But that was your like sort of like golden age of golf, really. That was that you?
That's when I got out there and started to
and just
go
started
to
see
courses
places and was like, yeah, I'm just going to throw myself at this.
Yeah.
But never marked a scorecard.
And Urban Golf, and it was a great, you know, the combination of being in central London, doing stuff with equipment, you know, all the guys I know now that I play loads of golf with, probably from people coming down to maybe have a putter done or something like that. And started getting invited to nice golf courses. So, and I was really enjoying that. I was really enjoying it not meaning anything, and getting into traveling and going on trips and having adventures. I think I did Matt Cranish for the first time in 2009, and that was a big start. And then I sort of decided in about 2015, I'm going to apply for my States back, which was quite a scary thing to do because...
Is that easy? I've never met someone that's had to go through that process. So how does that work?
It depends how much money you've made.
Because, I mean, fundamentally, the ruling around amateur status is around making a living from the game, I guess, for want of a better term. And if you were selling clubs at Stoke Park or whatever, and then you're still doing fittings here, I suppose it's quite hard to... You know, how important was that? I suppose just before we jump into the courses and stuff, like, you know,
I think the rules have relaxed quite a bit on making a living around. I used to know a guy called Mitch Voges, who was a US amateur champion. He had a fitting business, and he used to have issues with the USPGA around, you know, making a living out of the game. But for me, that didn't really come up. They ask you to list all of your earnings as a pro, which I sort of had. It was a bit depressing.
There wasn't much prize money in there,
40 quiders and stuff. So, and then the RNA come back to you. They write you a really proper letter, and they correct everything on your earnings. They've actually got, God knows how they do it. They've got all the records from these dodgy little pro events, you know.
No way.
Yeah. So they go back and they go, actually, this is what it is, and you know, you've got to wait 2 years. So I waited 2 years, and then I just started joining golf clubs, basically. Yeah. And now I'm back to being competitive like we were today.
Yeah, we should definitely give a shout out to that. So what do we, you know, for the benefit of our listeners, this pod's been long in the making. We said, look, you know, when are we going to do this? And we've moved the date around and said, well, let's play golf before. And I think I sent a message, well, where should we play golf? And he said, well, you know, I'd love to go back to the Addington, went there a few weeks ago. And then just so happens, Ryan, I speak to Ryan occasionally, and we got in touch on that day. It's just complete fluke. I said, oh, I'd really like to come play the Addington in a few weeks' time. And he very kindly set us up a tee time, and then you very kindly invited about another 15 other people, and then and the thing snowballed completely. There's a bit of VAT on this story, but we had nice two groups out today. It was... And, you know, I before we jump into your proper course diaries, I thought the Addington was sensational today. It was a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
I'm falling madly in love with the Addington.
Yeah.
I think that...
so much going for the holes, particularly now everything's sort of... There's still a huge amount of potential there, but like just the clearing away of everything just all of a sudden gets like, you know, it's like you're salivating when you come off a hole.
The thing with golf is change is so slow to happen. And when it comes to golf courses, you have to have people running them, owning them, that are brave enough to raise the bar and to do something better. And, you know, Ryan is doing that. And, you know, all credit to him, I think. He's what he's doing there, and the version of the game that he's going to present is going to be something which I think, makes quite a lot of places look out of date overnight.
It's innovative, and it'll be enjoyable. I mean, it is insanely good. Like, it was a lovely day today. And we were talking about it, weren't we, in on the train on the way over here, and the nature of, you know, proprietary and golf clubs and committees and that pace of change. And I guess, you know, we'll things like Sounder, which, you know, I don't know whether you would ever use the word disruptor in the marketplace, but I think, you know, the clothing and stuff and dress and fashion in golf is certainly a hot topic at the moment. And yeah, I guess, you know, you guys are probably brothers from another mother, maybe, in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I like this idea sometimes, you know, when people talk about supply and demand with businesses and stuff like that. I like this idea that sometimes the supply creates the demand. And I think that with golf, what's happening at the moment is there's a movement towards people getting back to more of a sort of minimized version of the game. And great mate of mine, Martin Ayres, I think the greatest golf teacher in the world.
Bigger than Mac O'Grady.
Underappreciated. but he comes out with this great saying, which is the world of golf has gotten a long way from the game of golf. And when you strip it back, I think there's more and more people now that are starting to see a different version and are very quickly moving to that different version. It's amazing how little loyalty people have to something when at a fundamental level they know it's kind of not quite right. And I think with golf, you know, the idea that you present what is now the pro version of the game, and I think the idea that pros, you know, listening to Greg Norman talk the other week about growing the game and all this stuff, that pro game is a very small part of the game. It's got the game is what's being played today and what's being played up, and it's very different. And
yeah, it's the flub chip shots that you and I managed,
and you don't necessarily have the same priorities. You know, you're not necessarily trying to nick a shot around. Some people are, and that's fine, you know, whatever. But that sort of idea that everything should be fair, everything should be perfect, and, you know, you should be trying to chase these sort of marginal gains and in that mindset, I think ultimately what that does is it takes away from the joy and the pleasure of playing the game, which, you know, we want to be competitive. But to be honest with you, when we went down the 18th today,
All square. You made me hole out like if a filthy 3.5 footer. You know,
well, we were all very generous, and I missed it.
And but, we were all square down last, and it was the enjoyment of just being heads up, wasn't it?
If we'd have lost on the 17th, I would have been upset for a little while, maybe 25 minutes or something. But you know, it's
you're a miserable character at the best of times.
We've all got a partner to blame, yeah. And you know, that gets us by.
Yeah. But, I mean, just moving on to the passions in the game. Golf travel, you know, I sense now is a huge part of your life and seeing it. So, you know, and when, you know, this eclectic 18 that we're going to talk through, there's a huge selection of American courses on here. Like, yeah. There's some absolute blockbusters. Yeah. So, you know, you just don't expect it. And I seem to remember this one coming through actually when we launched the exercise. So I think you were well ahead of the curve. This wasn't sort of requested. But, you know, I'm running through it here. There's something in the order of, what, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, 9. It's 50% leaning towards the US. So, you know, just talk me through, you know, golf travel, golf courses. You know, I suppose I get the sense that, you know, maybe mid-20s now onwards, you start to look at new golf courses with a sense of excitement, and maybe that's a fondness for architecture, maybe it's a fondness for just clubby feels. What is it that grabs your attention?
I basically like, my one true love is links golf, but we're lucky, aren't we? We get to do so much of it. And then I have a major thing for sort of, I guess, like luxurious American golf. It done in the right way. It's
unapologetically. I just really like trophy courses in America.
I like the sort of the weirdness of it. Like, I remember when I first went and played a few plays. I met a friend in New York. I was talking to somebody, which I've done so many times, I wish I'd done it, about opening urban golfs in America, and they wanted to do the first one in New York, and we were in a bar, and he had kids, so he had to go home. And I'll always remember this. There were two, it was one of those sort of New York type bars, PJ Clark's it was. And there were two girls across the bar, and I'm looking across them, I'm thinking, hell, you know, they're quite nice. And I was single at the time. And when he left, I thought, well, maybe, you know, I might get chatting with them or something. And then in my left ear, which is the only ear I can hear out of, I heard two guys talking about Lynx golf courses. And I completely forgot about them. And
you didn't realise it, but you were at a crossroads in your life at
both,
that point.
They both great guys, still know them today. But one of those guys, Glenn, I used to go back to New York, visit him, and he used to be able to get us on at all these cool places. And that's sort of what, and that's a great example of how I think, we've seen it with Sounder, you know, because we've done something with Sounder, so many people have come out of the woodwork. We've met so many like-minded people.
Yeah.
And I think that's the great thing about golf, and that's the great thing about loving a certain type of golf, is that you pretty much get along with, you know, all the people you meet. It's brilliant.
Yeah. So, and I think the same can be said with, you said it with Cookie Jar, and like you say, you know, we've become, you know, close over the last sort of year or two, really.
But there's something
interesting about the girls in the bar there. That feels like a sliding doors moment. That genuinely does. I'd love to see how that movie plays out. But I'd be particularly interested in hearing about how the New York leg went in terms of golf. We've touched on it. Your card that we're looking at here, there's been a bit of tweaking, I will add, because you seem to have... I'm going to kick it off. Rather than kick it off at the first, I'm going to kick it off on the back nine. Because there seems to be some vague memories around the 10th and 11 holes in particular.
Well, I'm very bad at remembering golf courses.
Well,
that's the caveat
doing
to this.
The 10th at Sunningdale Old was listed. So yeah. that's good golf hole. Funny enough, Richie Ramsey had that in his, which was the last Eclectic 18. And James put 300 yards. I thought, that's never right. No, it's 450 yards-ish. So I thought, James, it just doesn't feel right. Are you going to play us from the junior tee box or something? Oh, no. I mean, the 11th, it's right after the halfway house. Then we have exactly the same situation when they're trying to shoehorn Raul Dornick in as number 10.
I know, yeah.
And telling me it was the par 4.
Does anyone enjoy...
Is there something around halfway houses? And I sense most of the holes you mentioned around the turn were quite key around the halfway house.
Well, I think when... Does Dornick have a halfway house?
Yeah, it does. Just off the right to the par 5 green.
I haven't been
it's
to
all
Dornick.
Hidden neatly
I haven't been
between
to Dornick
the,
for
between
about
the
six, probably 6 to 8 years, and I'm not sure it happened, but... I do like the halfway point. My rounds of golf competitively tend to be sort of can be quite solid for 8. Then I'm waiting for a disaster to happen.
Yeah.
It usually happens around 9, 10, 11, and then I'll get into the fight back mode and play quite well coming in. So it is a crucial moment in the round for me. But yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? I always think of that hole as number 10. And actually, I does anybody really love number 10 on Sunningdale Old? It's probably...
It's tough as nails.
It's not a
it's
joy,
tough
is
nails.
It, that hole?
Yeah. You know, and you know, like you say, I think... I mean, how do you sum it up best? The 11th at Sunningdale Old, you just had, what, a little sausage sandwich and...
Yeah, and so I don't do the bread. I've worked it out.
Okay.
No bread, just a sausage and a large whiskey Mac. And I think I've won the next two holes because everybody else is walking out bloated. I mean, I've tested it here. You get a really good sense at Urban Golf with how many beers are optimum for you and that hamburgers are not good for your swing. So, yeah, single sausage and a whiskey Mac. And then actually 11, not 10, 11 at Sunningdale, hit driver.
Yeah.
Get it up there
and just
and
slam
then
it down
hit
there.
Some sort of... shovel bunt where the eight iron soul never leaves the ground.
Yeah. I've seen a few
hockey
of those
shot
today.
The green.
Yeah. Just a short backswing. In terms of your Eclectic 18, what are the holes there that you know you look at and go, do you know what? Yeah, these are. I had to put these down, or maybe there's a hole that.
Well, yeah, so there's certain holes here, isn't there? There are certain holes here that you kind of think, oh God, where's there a great six? But. I think 8 at Pebble Beach is just an amazing hole. You know, I play Pebble on the Sims all the time, so I feel like I know it quite well. But it's just so spectacular. And I think that whole Pebble Beach experience speaks to something, which is I'm trying to be into golf course architecture, but I find that when I go to places, they just have an overall impact on me. And sometimes I find it very difficult to remember
separate the experience from the holes.
And also when I'm playing them I forget to look at it, and when I read Jeff Shackelford Grounds for Golf, I think that's a brilliant book because it tries to get people to just start looking at the course and understanding what it is, you know, is it a penal design, is it a strategic design, And I do think actually that makes you a better player. Yeah, so Pebble for me is just so spectacular and very hard to play and not get quite overexcited. Passatiempo was a absolute watershed moment for me because it helped me. I tried to read McKenzie's stuff and it really helped me to understand his principles. And
where did we land on Passatiempo? Was that second?
On 10, yeah. It's 10. That one with the Barranca or whatever, and you go up.
We're
hill.
On 10 Passatiempo now.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's been some tweaking at the 11th hour on this.
Yeah, and I just think the thing with Passatiempo is you hit these shots into the greens and you can seal the slopes. You can seal the slopes on the green. You can see the ball land. You can see the ball move off of slopes. For some reason, that is so engaging when it comes to hitting shots in. You know, I played the West this weekend, last weekend, Wentworth West. And I'm trying to fall back in love with the West, but there are so many shots where you sort of, you know, you can see where the flag position is and you're picking a line, but you can't see the ball land. And
it speaks more to an execution challenge, I think, some of these courses. And I think, one thing you notice there is there's a lot of golden age greats. You know, a lot of it, there's not many modern classics from memory. I might be wrong on that. But, that thinking man's golf is just absolutely key.
Yeah, I think every hole should have a general idea. I know that it's a lot more nuanced than that, and I think you do have to. I'm also now, I've been on so many trips where I've just gone on this succession of one course to the next. I'm a big fan now of really getting to know a place, and I think there's no greater example of that in the old course. You know, you will never learn every pin position on that course, but maybe you will one day.
But you're right. I mean, there's so many people that I think in golf travel will, fill an itinerary, whether it's an American going to Scotland saying, well, I'm going to play Muirfield in the morning, I'm going to play the Jubilee in the afternoon, then the Old Course the next morning, then I'm going to go to Ely, then I'm going to drive across and play Turnberry. It's like, whoa,
yeah,
just play Muirfield five times,
exactly,
and understand the nuance.
And why do
wins.
So many people say, oh, I played the Old Course, I didn't think it was all that.
Yeah,
it's one hit wonder,
you've not played it, like,
exactly.
It grows, you know.
Yeah, and I also really don't like this idea that a course is the same time every time you play it. You're just trying to hit the same shot every time, which is probably what Sawgrass is, to be honest with you. I'm just not that, you know, I understand. I appreciate Sawgrass. To be honest with you, on The Sims, Sawgrass is a brilliant course because with The Sims, you've always got a perfect lie. You've got 12-foot gimmies. You just
pretty
want,
much
some,
like
you just want
it,
targets,
actually.
You know. And
you're offering the cheapest green fees at Sawgrass
exactly.
In the country.
Exactly. And then I'm just looking at this list.
Merrion, by the way, we should add, Merrion is the... We've done two guest Eclectic 18 podcasts now. In both of those scenarios, we've had Merrion as the first hole. Why?
Yeah.
I've not been to Merrion.
Amazing outdoor terrace bar, which is touching the tee.
Okay.
And it is a great hole as well. It's dogleg to the right. And
Richie Ramsey gave this analogy of you can hear cutlery clattering on the first tee and stuff.
Yeah, and if you're with a group, they can hear them screaming at you.
And it's sort of proximity. And
I think that's pretty cool, yeah. I like that.
Hogan
but,
affinity,
to be honest
maybe.
With you, I could do this Eclectic 18 another three times and it would come out completely differently. But the places are the key. You're always thinking, I think when you try and think of your best hole, you think about where you've had the best time and you want to get them in there. So Monterey Peninsula was a place that I could not believe that place. I just thought it was absolutely amazing. We organized a trip. And two of us took on the job of organising the golf, which we left too late. It was in October. And we couldn't get any of the courses that everybody wanted to play. And we were struggling to come clean to the other guys. And one of our people dropped out. And a friend of ours in the US hooked us up with this guy. The guy's name's Jack Grancolis, brilliant bloke, from San Francisco. And he was a member at Monterey Peninsula, which completely saved the trip. Because now everyone, we played there like three times and the other places we could get booked, and we just had the best time. And it's totally, I mean, it's, but you come down to the ocean, I think, is it 14 I put on there?
You put 13, par
13,
four,
yeah.
About 350.
So that is like right down on the ocean. You got to hit a little fade with the tee shot, a bit of a tree to the right of the green, if I remember. But just a moment which was, I think it was our second 18 of the day, and I always think back to that. It was just brilliant, you know, sun going down, amazing. Always remember that.
And I think those memories live long, don't they? I mean, I'm just going to run through the scorecard and just you know, for posterity at least. But your scorecard is it's an unevenly matched one. It's a par 71. You're out in 34 and you're back in 37, which maybe speaks a little bit to your sort of your MO in the golfing game. You know, there's usually a bit of a
I didn't even think of that.
Of an ambulance moment coming home. So I don't know if there's something in that, but it's a par 71, 6,500. Long. Played with you today, big hitter, and you know, I sense you like the challenge. We've got Merrion first, par 4, 340. Rye second, a superb par 3. Yeah, very, very good shout.
And I can't play that hole, by the way.
You know, it's a two ball club, and the reality is if you play 4,
turn it over.
Just take the odds.
Turn it over, long left, dead.
It's just one of many great par 3s, isn't it? Yeah. I think. Muirfield 3, Spyglass 4. Royal North Devon 5, Sunningdale New. Interesting not to pick a par 3 from Sunningdale New, by the way.
That par 5 is 6, the par 5.
Great
golf. I think
hole.
It's one of the great par 5s in the world. Yeah. I think that hole is just amazing, I think. Unbelievably tough for somebody with no short game. But terrifying. There's nothing scary about the second shot unless you're worried about chipping.
But I mean, the whole list is just a smorgasbord of great golf clubs. You know, LACC 7, Pebble Beach 8, Swinley Forest 9, going to the back 9, Pasatiempo 10, Sunny Old 11, per the confusion, Riviera 12. You know, Riviera 10. It's like we were searching for a 10th hole on the train, I seem to remember. MPCC.
No, I don't think that's a great hole anymore, though,
isn't
it?
Yeah, just.
But I'm only going by Shaq.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, and that's what you have to base it on. But you've played these courses. Friars Head 14, North Berwick 15, the Redan, Macrahanish Dunes 16, Old Course 17, and Secession 18. Yeah, like, wow. Now, I mean, those courses there are, yeah, they're some of the most revered courses around the world. Dress code is quite a key thing in the world right now. You know, we see, you know, I don't know whether we see standards slipping in the game maybe, or, you know, moving away from maybe certain standards that were expected, whether it was the collar and tie in the clubhouse, whether it's the hoodie on the golf course, I don't know. As a traditionalist, like a purist, you know, someone who's, you know, reveres Hogan, where does sounder clothing fit in all that? Because, you know, my observation, I'm just being a controversialist here. You could look at Sounder Golf and go, it's maybe a bit of hipster golfer clothing. But, yeah. You know, I know that's not necessarily personality.
We're slotting into that bit at the moment, but I don't think that's what we're doing. So Cathal McAteer, my dear friend and partner in Sounder, I remember when I opened Urban Golf in Soho and I had a bit of a shopping habit and I used to go up to Liberty's and they would sell folk clothing in Liberty's, and I used to buy it and loved it. And then Cathal came in for a fitting one day 4 years ago, and we got chatting. I worked out that he was folk. We got along like a house on fire. We still do. And I tried to convince him to do a golf thing because at the time I wasn't wearing any golf clothing. You know, I think that period of time between opening in Soho and now, I guess, I was involved in golf and running a golf business, but I was in no way engaged with the sort of golf industry. And we have to go to the trade show, the PGA show, every year, and because of the simulator business, and sort of go, and I was getting more and more disillusioned with the industry. And not that I
feel... You don't strike me as a white belt kind of guy.
No, well, it's not that I felt any sort of animosity towards it. I just didn't really feel like it was something I wanted to get too involved in. So... I was already wearing folk clothing. Cathal came along and we just started to make golf stuff, which is brilliant. You know, I love his stuff. We get along like a house on fire. And, you know, I mean, I'm head to toe in our stuff today. But to be honest with you, if I didn't like our stuff, I actually wouldn't wear it. That Hogan speech where he says to the team, you've got these uniforms, but wear what you want to wear. You know, I'm uncompromising enough about my golf that... So anyway, slightly digressing... I think golf club dress code should be in keeping with the prestige and the history of the club. So I think if you're a club that's open in the last 5 years, don't start trying to impose the same things as a club that's been open for 100 years that has got a great history. And
but hoodies at Muirfield, you're comfortable on the rules.
No,
being,
I think what we
no
what
hoodies,
we're,
so, like, so it's a private
getting,
club.
Getting back to the point, what we're trying to create is a range where you can dress it up or dress it down. You know, you can tuck the shirt in, you can wear the shirt untucked. To be honest, I play up at when if I go up at to Highgate, which is just up the road from where we live in the evenings, I will go out there in a t-shirt with no collar. And I love it.
Yeah, cap backwards. But, I've seen the Instagram evidence.
But I don't want to play at Muirfield just yeah. like that.
No.
I don't
because you'd
to.
Feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I want
you
to sort
knock
of dress
it forward, and you
yeah.
can. You can
and if you've got to,
smart up,
if you're lucky enough to go and play at Sunningdale, dress it up a bit. But take so I think to be able to hit the whole range and to be able to go up and down is really nice, and we've really tried to do that. We've got stuff which is quite classic. We've got stuff that you know, and to be honest with you, I'm wearing it. On and off the course to work.
I think that's nice. Refreshing. Look, yeah. I mean, look, you know, this isn't about, you know, look, I'll give you my personal take on Sounder. When we, I think you came to our first golf event in June, or John did, in June, and really enjoyed himself. And I was just heckling him, saying, you know, this is like Ben Hogan slacks, like baggy trousers. But he was like, I'll send you a pair and see how you get on with them. And I didn't put them on until... I want to say like October, November, just hadn't put them on for whatever reason. I was like, oh my God, these things, like you could live in these trousers.
Yeah.
And then I've gradually kind of started wearing some of this stuff. And oh, this is brilliant. Yeah, it's really nice clothing.
Yeah.
I do think when I look at, you know, whether it's the golf media landscape, you know, back to your original point, you know, we were previously brought up on a diet of, you know, golf magazines, and this is where you go, and this is what you do, and this is how you behave. And now we're in an Instagram generation where there's disruptors for disruptors' sake, and it's very easy to be an armchair pundit and say, well, yeah, Muirfield should allow hoodies, and that, you know, why on earth shouldn't you be able to wear jeans playing at Cypress Point? But it's just a, you know, I think it's important to be nuanced, and I think that's kind of where I think it sort of strikes a sweet spot with people who are maybe traditionalists,
yeah.
who well, you know just want something a bit more different.
But I would say if you
I
love
mean, that's dress or you know if, you know what I mean. Yeah, that's everything.
I,
right?
I would say this: if you love golf, you will love Winter Park.
Yeah,
right. And Winter Park for us when we go to this golf trade show in Orlando, you basically
it's a nine-holer in Florida, right?
Yeah, but in Orlando, we always felt like. You could pay $80 for a round of golf, or you could pay $200 for a round of golf, and the delta, the difference in the price, was all about the condition of the course. It didn't mean you were going to remember any of the holes, or that it was a great design. And so, you know, we have always played golf, and we've gone there. You have to do something, and we filled our buggies up with beers, and then we discovered Winter Park, and we literally, and Winter Park is 45 minutes drive, and it is a community golf course. I think it was Keith. Was it Keith Rebb? Yes, it's Keith Rebb. He underbid to get that project because it is a little nine-hole course which winds through this gorgeous suburb, which yeah. we would have never known was there. No rough, brilliant green complexes, and just a hoot. It's so much fun. And I think you can appreciate both ends. You know, you don't always want to get beaten up. Sometimes you want to go out and have a good time with half a set. And the basic fundamental... things about architecture that make golf fun is options.
Yeah.
And what options create the possibility of multiple outcomes rather than hit it there. If you don't hit it there, you're dead, you're out. You know, it's that's what I think great architecture does. And I think that's what Winter Park was really highlighted to me. And that's why I'm always on it. You know, Highgate, the club that we play at, which is just up the road, local to us, and is so brilliant because we go up there and 5 minutes from home. If you live in London, you've got a golf course 5 minutes from home, you don't care what it's like.
Yeah.
But I think all holes should have a basic idea. You know, oh, it all comes in from that way, or it all comes in from this way. And obviously there are more advanced courses than that. But you play so many of these what I think are the key to growing the game, really, which is sort of sub 6,000-yard courses, which if they had... basic fundamental strategic value to their designs would be a much better version of the game for so many people.
Rather than convincing someone they need to spend £300 on clothing and, you know, £500 motor caddy and send them out to the Belfry where they're going to lose 15 golf balls, take 5 hours and shoot 150.
It's just not as good.
It's just not the.
It's just not good.
It's just not the game. We'll close on this because I just wanted to. I know we touched on some niche stuff early doors, and I felt like we couldn't disappear down this rabbit warren. But talked about the swing and equipment, and you're a big junkie on that. I would say.
Swing
flat. You have a certain ethos around this. Give me your ethos on the golf swing. I'm by no means an expert. This is where we would need to bring Bruce into the conversation to have an educated
exchange.
Okay, so
I'm just going to try and make the maximum impact, I guess. I don't believe in geometry and looking at swings on video and looking at still pictures of swings and asking people to get into positions. I think the game has two fundamental skills. One is precision. You know, if you're a beginner, it's hitting it out the middle of the face. If you're an advanced golfer, it's getting it to go where you want it to go when you hit it out the middle of the face. And the other thing is dynamics. I call it dynamics, which is using the club to put a good strike on the ball. And the art of golf is marrying those things up, and it is an art. I fundamentally believe that it's an art, and I think that's why it can turn into a brilliant practice for our lives, because being able to do something in a way where your mind is open enough to be able to be intuitive, rather than it being paint by numbers, and rather than it being, okay, you know, I'm going to stand here, I'm going to get it into these positions, and I'm going to hope it works. I believe in ownership.
And do you think, you know, maybe some of the old greats, you know, but, you know, we started this podcast with a sloppy Hogan reference by myself. By the way, your dog's also called Hogan, so you're just going to chuck that one out there as well at the same time. He should be. Do you see a massive difference in terms of the way the best players today swing the club versus maybe how they did 50, 60, 70 years ago?
Well, I do, but I also think there are a lot of trends which are immediately considered to be progress, which aren't necessarily. You know, wouldn't it be a short-lived thing if, you know, Bryson comes out, plays one season, and all of a sudden can't be not injured? Thousands of college players have already changed their trajectory based on the initial bit. But anyway,
there's so much content out there, be it on Instagram from a guy who's a club pro who's got half an hour spare and he's just got an idea he wants to run by you. And it's like, you know what? Actually, there's almost too much out there now on the swing.
Well, there is. But I also think we have to go back to the core, which is this. As humans, like golf, we were talking about this today. You know, how many situations do you put yourself in when you're a middle-aged person? Like,
you
genuinely crapping yourself.
And I was 17th green against myself James over Davis, that 3.5 foot. Yeah.
And what it does is it exposes that sort of human frailty in all of us, where we are very susceptible to wanting to take a shortcut. And commercially, what happens is, you know, the infomercial with the guy telling you, I've got the key, you know, I've got the secret. And there's so much of that out there, telling people that, you know, something's going to completely change their golf game. And the reason that they're not as good as they want to be is because they just don't know something. You know, the reality is, if you spent time around great players, they're not just great golfers. They're great at all sorts of things. They're like Jedis, you know.
And, I love this.
You know, for the rest of us, the value is in, like, do I enjoy golf more or less because I'm better than I was 20 years ago?
Are you better than you were 20 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
That's made me feel good.
that's how bad I was. And, you know, it's about that thing of getting out there and trying to be better, but accepting that there aren't any shortcuts. And trying to have some sort of ownership around, okay, understanding it, but understanding what it is to me and what my good is and the direction that I need to go in. And I think that's a much more human thing than the ones and the zeros can ever tell us. And I think, you know, we were talking about it today, and just to give you an example, when somebody goes for a golf lesson and the coach says, you're swinging it, you know, four from the inside and you need to be here or here, there's no why or how to that necessarily. And sometimes that can be used as a crutch or an indemnifier, whereas there used to be a time where these pros had, you know, genuine knowledge and could pass on information around hitting shots.
Well, you take it back to the very beginnings. You know, the club professional was also the person who looked after the links, made the golf balls, managed the equipment. Yeah. I mean, literally, at its most fundamental level, you know, not just fitting manufacturer club, made the clubs from scratch.
And the joy of the game is how ephemeral it is. You know, when we were playing today, and I don't know if you noticed, but I had a little patch where I was throwing a few darts, and they were going in there pretty
They
close.
All looked pretty tidy, to be fair.
But there was just a bit towards the end.
I felt like I was on the ropes towards the end. We were running out of road. I had to get this closed out.
I started to get that feeling where I was like, wow, you know, I'm standing over the ball and I feel like I'm going to hit a good shot.
Yeah,
and then
17 flagged.
18 when we were under the cosh. I'm stood there with a 5-iron in. I'm feeling pretty good. But I just couldn't not get involved.
Put you under the pump with that 2-iron, to be fair.
Of course you did. I tried not to look. I didn't even know what you'd done at
You must have heard it come over your head.
But it's just, and you can just screw it up from the tiniest little thing. And that doesn't mean that you should turn around and say, "Whoa, what did I do with my swing there?" You just got a bit involved. You know, you just screwed it up. And that's the nuance of the game. And that's the beauty of the game, is how fine those lines are. And I think sometimes if you shy away from that by going down this route of wanting to measure everything and wanting to, you know, see what happened on this one or that one. I mean, it's the tiniest things, isn't it? It's a slight miss hit. Slightly out of toe, slightly out of heel, and that's the beauty of it. But trying to lock it down takes away the joy.
I have loads of follow-up questions, but I actually feel that's a beautiful way to end this podcast, if I'm honest.
We've got a discount.
Well, that is on my list of closing comments, but thank you for the reminder.
Sorry.
That's very kind of you.
Drive traffic.
But it is a very good way to close the podcast. Look, I'm going to be real. It's a great way to close this. The even better way would be to give you a discount code. So if you go to soundofgolf.com and enter Cookie Jar at checkout, you will receive 15% off any order. Now, look, I think any listeners of this podcast that have heard 130 episodes to date, or 124, however many we're into at this stage, know that we are not the most commercially minded creatures. The slacks are good. James out in the Grenson golf shoes, which, you know, I've just, you know, fallen in love with today, and some of the apparel is first class. I'm a huge fan. We'd leave that with you to percolate. But James, look, it's been a real pleasure getting to do that with you, like, and spend this afternoon just playing together urban golf, and just kind of get inside your head a little bit in terms of, like, your ethos on golf and stuff. Like, I think you're an absolute golf nutter. and I think those, you know, that's why we try and lock people like you in a room and just talk to you for an hour straight. So a big thank you for your time. And
well, thanks. And, you know, hopefully lots more great afternoons, maybe a few full days,
many more to come, and a few more events. So until then,
watch this.